I didn't know all the stuff that I brought. It was just a matter of dumping a whole pile of things into boxes and then trying to figure out what the crazy friends were that I would show you. I've decided not to show any particularly new crazy friends. Some have already asked for some special things. If you see, or if there's those of you that are familiar with this enterprise, have some suggestions, we may do some more later on this week. But I've picked three sets. The first, and I guess this is a bad policy, it's kind of like announcing your sermon outline at the beginning, and now you'll know how much more you'll have to take after each one of these things. But the first one that I want to talk about is a group of artists from a period we call the Romanesque in France. And my favorite of those artists, a fellow by the name of Gisilbertus. Do you remember Gisilbertus, anybody?
I do.
I hope that I... Thank you, Jimmy. Jimmy remembers. Now you be quiet. If I repeat from some things we've done this past summer and previous summers, I'm sorry. I'm not quite sure what all is available and rememberable and what isn't. But I just thought I'd pick out some immediate favorites. So Gisilbertus and his Romanesque cohorts are the first ones, and I do that because they're funny and delightful. The next one that I'll talk about is Matthias Grunewald, and I do him because it's a commercial for the Grunewald Guild. We'll talk more about that, but he is also full of fantasy and wonderment, and very strange indeed. And the last one that I'll show you is Saint Vincent of Arles, Vincent van Gogh, mainly because he is not listed among the great ecclesiastical artists, probably not even listed among the significant religious artists. But to my way of thinking, even though he was definitely mad, he was a saint, which should be a comfort to all of us. Okay. These are all very different periods, okay? And the first one is even before the Gothic Age. It's what we call the Dark Ages. Which doesn't mean that they didn't know what they were doing or couldn't see their way around. It means that we don't know what they were up to and don't understand some of the reasons why they did what they did. It's kind of neat. When I was an undergraduate, lo these many years, the Dark Ages comprised a period from about 300 to 1200. Now it comprises a period from about 900 to 1000. So as we learn more, the Dark Ages is getting smaller and smaller, and that's kind of nice. It's chauvinistic, but it's interesting. The period has a lot of reasons, a lot of context for its text. I follow Jim Burtness in that. You can't look at any art without understanding the context out of which it comes, and we obviously don't have time to go into a lot of the context, but it only makes sense if you really understand some of the context. Romanesque art starts in the year 1000 and goes to the year 1200. It stopped at 1200 because the Gothic Age had taken over and started doing some of the things that the Romanesque people had discovered and were able to carry it on. But it got started for a lot of reasons. Not the least interesting is the year 1000 itself, when an awful lot of people in Christendom, which in Europe was an awful lot of people, probably most of them, they thought the world was coming to an end. Now, when you think the world is coming to an end in a year or two, you don't build great building projects and mortgage your congregation for 35 years. So about the year 999, all buildings stopped. Everything stopped. It was, people read a lot of books. They prayed a lot. They did an awful lot of breastfeeding. And all the debts were paid. Everybody was really good. It was like the 5 years before Christmas. The year 1000 came, and nothing happened. And 1001 and 1002, people gave God a couple extra years. They were not, of course, absolutely certain that their calendar and God's calendar were the same calendar. So they gave him 4 years. And in the year 1004, they went berserk. Absolutely berserk. One little monk, a fellow by the name of Raoul Glauber, wrote in his diary. I kid you not. Would I make up a name like Raoul Glauber? No, I wouldn't. He wrote in his diary that churches began springing up all over Europe like mushrooms in the springtime. To give you an idea of how many, between the year 904 and 1004 and 1075, 400 cathedrals were built within an area 50 miles by 50 miles. They must have overlapped. I don't know where they put them all. And they were not dinky. They were enormous. And almost all of them were dedicated to the angel Michael. Michael, who is the angel of judgment. For favors granted. Thanks for not coming down and ending all of this. We're having a good time, and we're building churches and building them with enthusiasm beyond their means, because these people, in all of their history up to this time, had not been great builders. All of these people had come in the migrations from as far away as Siberia. Their main contribution to the history of art was books and the making of manuscripts and beautiful, beautiful books. Portable art, not great big buildings. So these people, as they celebrated the judgment and their release from it, if only temporarily, went into a media which was totally new and strange and experimental. The only models that they had were buildings built by the Romans. That went, of course, all the way up to England. Romans had built buildings all over the place, and some of those were still standing. So these people copied some of it, started inventing some of their own, but that's why we call this the Romanesque age. But there is more difference between this and the way the Romans built than there are similarities. Well, at any rate, some of the things look like this. Great, huge walls. You know, you could get up on the top and pour boiling oil down on the Christmas carolers and, you know, just protect yourself from all manner of harassment. It was, it really was a time in which the church was sort of an Einfestburg. They were supposed to be protecting the people from invaders, and there was still invasion going on. So they built these. This is called a west work. And it simply means that it's the opposite end of the east work. The east, all these churches were built facing the east. So this is the entrance. A huge monolithic thing. It's really not very pretty.
Rich, what was the little arrow down in the
middle? That's a street sign. I'm sorry, this thing. Yes, that's a street sign. I don't know whether it changes according to the church year. If it does, this would be Good Friday. But I'm sure that this picture was only taken a couple years ago. So.
Doorbell. We thought maybe it pointed out the doorbell.
Oh, the doorbell? Certainly not the doorbell, probably the alms box. Incredible stuff. Jay, it's just great big huge walls.
Rich, is there any way we could get you to move right in front of us?
Well, it'd probably be easy, since this is the end of the cord, is there any way I can get you to move?
Well,
I know it's warm over there, isn't it? Wherever I move, I'll be in front of somebody. Okay, how's that? Okay?
That's great.
Am I okay? Okay. Kit, the little car does not go with the building, okay? Also, the clock came later on this building, but it kind of does fit the... Kit, huge masses of masonry. These people were concerned about protection. In a sense, their style was evidence that they were concerned for hiding out. That is one philosophy of church architecture, that you go in there and escape. And these buildings were really a sanctuary.
Could you tell where these are?
The last one was in Italy. The first two were in France, northern France. And on the top, over the door of every single church built between 1000 and 1200 was this huge Christus called a Pantocrator. Yeah, if you could lower that, that'd be neat. The top is more important than the bottom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Screw it down a little bit, Bill.
Yeah, there's a little... Okay. I've got slides of all different sizes, so it's a little bit hard to... That's excellent.
Lower it and zoom it out.
It's a good thing I don't have a music program to go with it.
What would you play for that?
Something Gregorian. Yeah. No, not that. Give me a break. But over the entrance to all these churches, every single one of them was a Christ sitting on the throne of judgment called a Pantocrator. And around were symbols of the judgment. Literally, when you walked in the church, you walked under the judgment. You passed through the judgment. And this is the era in church architecture of what has now become affectionately known as ghoulies, ghosties, and long-leggedy beasties. They are all over the place. For example, if you don't start telling the truth, you will go to hell and spend eternity having your tongue pulled out by a demon. There he is, with a pliers pulling the tongue of a liar. Right smack on the front of the cathedral, judgment and law was a very strong motif for these people, even though the year 1000 has already passed. Abelard and Eloise hadn't been born yet, but if they had, that's probably them in the upper right-hand corner. Boy, you can almost smell the breath of that guy. It's really a very rude devil.
His finals at Balfour.
Yeah, no. That's on the Michelangelo's Last Judgment. I've got one for that. Remember from the book of Acts of the Apostles, where a guy thought he was Jesus Christ, or contended he was Jesus Christ and could fly, and a magician, and he fell. And there is St. Peter holding a huge key on the left,
saying something like, nye, 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 nye. And on the right, a devil who is just waiting for him to hit bottom. All kinds of these demons all over the churches. This is avarice. Yeah, mouths are very big in the Romanesque age. This fellow is a two-legged mouth. There's Michael on the left and a demon on the right, and they are holding the scales of judgment. Look at the little fellow hiding under Michael's skirt. Isn't that neat? Look at down in the lower left. Little guy, just hiding, scared to death. The churches, as I say, were enormous, and the biggest of all of them was a church that doesn't exist anymore, called Cluny. Cluny was the center of an enormous order. The Cluniac order had 300 sister monasteries all over Europe, all over Central Europe. The center one, the main monastery, the headquarters, was in Cluny, which is in Burgundy, France, and this was their church, three times longer than St. Peter's in Rome. Just absolutely humongous. And built a little model of the thing, and actually gives you an idea of what the churches were like in those days. You can see it's almost like two churches stuck together. Sort of like the Valpo Chapel, right? I mean, you got the ecclesiastical church with all of its fancy little abutments so that you can have altars stuck in there so that all the priests that are there can do their mass every day. Then you got the barn hooked onto that for the laity. This is about the time in which laity or layman becomes a dirty word. And it still is. I mean, if you want to apologize for your ignorance, just say, I'm only a layman. Means you're stupid.
Why was this torn down or taken?
It burned. It burned. It was partly because of the building construction that used a lot of wood up in the upper areas, and of course it was enormously high. Tremendous heat wound up in there, and most of the churches built with wood beams in the ceilings burned just from spontaneous combustion. How long? I think it was something like 1,100 feet. All right, now think of the judgment motif. These people have tremendous faith. They are building things like they have never built before, and we've got almost a double side of the faith picture illustrated during this time. One side being this fear of the judgment, this dread of eternal hellfire, and the other side of the faith picture being foolishness, giddiness, literal giddiness. And you're all familiar with this enterprise. Some of your moms have salt and pepper shakers to match. But now look at this thing. Pisa is 20 miles from Carrara. Carrara is the world's largest marble quarry. Okay? They've got enough marble still in Carrara to finish all the bathrooms in the world until kingdom come. It's just with every single color you want, black, white, pink, green, all of it, okay? So they start building where all building churches start building, and that's at the crossing. You start at the altar place, you finish the arms and the transepts, and then you build forward so that this is the last thing to get finished, okay? So they start here, and what they're going to do it in is pink and white marble. They want to do it in pink and white. So they start down here, and they just get fed up right about here. They just get totally bored with pink and white. I don't know whether Luigi says to, you know, I'm fed up. It's getting a little garish, kind of gauche, whatever that is. left-handed. in Italian, but at any rate, they just got fed up and started white. From here on, it's all white. No reason for it, except they just felt like changing it. They changed a lot of other stuff at the same time. They had these arches going all the way up to this little string course up here, and about the time when they decided to change the color, they changed this space. You got a window, a blank, window blank, window blank, window blank, window blank, window blank, window blank, blank. There's absolutely no reason for that not to have a window in it. Where is that window? It's over here. And it doesn't belong there because there is no room in there. It's just a wall. Alright?
Maybe there's an air conditioner.
No.
Now that's left hemisphere. Now that's the inside of that. That's the inside of Pisa Cathedral. Alright? I hope you realize what I'm doing. You can see this. Not the way artists are used to moving. This staircase is 17 feet from the nearest wall. You can't, you'd have to pull it off over to get on. And there's a stairwell that goes up to a door. That door is painted on the wall. You gotta love that. If you realize you're laughing at churches, I hope you do. If that's all right with you, it's all right with me, but I think it's silly. And it is so silly. It is so silly that I'll tell you how silly it is. It is so silly that I am convinced that this was built to tilt. That it was actually built on an angle. I really am. There, it's getting worse because the ground is softer, but there are seven towers leaning in seven different directions in the city of Bologna, and nobody says, you know, is that very strange? There's a tower in Ravenna that leans over one of the main streets, and everybody goes up and spits on the cars, and nobody says, wow, is that ever cute? But everybody says, this is the Leaning Tower. But all the others were built at an angle. It was that kind of an age. I'll give you some other examples. Look, they were trying all different kinds of ways of building. Alright, a couple of different architectural and engineering styles. The most traditional thing was to do what's called a barrel vault. Just like a long arch going down the aisle. Alright? Well, these people said if we do a barrel vault going down the aisle, we'll have to pile a whole lot of masonry on the side. We won't get any windows in there. So what we'll do is we'll turn the barrel vaults around this way and we'll have them go down the aisle like that, and we'll stick windows into the sides of each of those little barrel vaults. So they did that, but they didn't like the idea of doing that same cuckoo thing on the side aisle, so they put one barrel vault intersecting another barrel vault, and this little project was the invention of what we call the groin vault. And that's how Gothic architecture got started. Okay, with this, just this little gimmicky enterprise. These people were just fooling around one afternoon, and they invented Gothic. Okay, at the same time, however, in the process of fooling around, they came up with other interesting solutions. You check that door down in the lower left-hand corner. That's a little chapel, the door to a chapel. Check the third step. That is a 14-foot drop. And you could say on the basis of the slide, well, maybe there was something down here that prevents them from having a normal staircase going up to it, but there isn't. There's a lot of room, all kinds of room. You can just spread it out a nice long staircase up there, but no. The interesting thing is that the chapel is only 18 inches deep and the door won't open anyway. I honestly believe they were laughing when they did it too. I mean, these are my crazy friends, okay? And I really believe these people did not have both oars in the water. But at the same time, I really think that their faith allowed them this sense of foolishness. Faith is really, the building of a whole thing like this is kind of foolish anyway. And they did it with real gusto. Okay. And that leads us to Gizelbertus. He was a sculptor, just a sculptor. And almost all of his work is done in one place, a little cathedral in a small town called Autun, the Church of Saint Lazare, Saint Lazarus. And this is his tympanum, his judgment scene over the entrance. Now, Gizelbertus was a master carver. Some of the demons you saw before are his. And all of the carving in this one church was done by this one man who studied at Cluny and then moved over to Autun and lived there for 10 years while with the congregation, worshipped with them, and then executed this work. And he, for me, really epitomizes this double-sided image of faith. Here is an eave, which originally was over one of the side entrances to the church. She is beautiful. She is just fantastic. She is crawling like a serpent. We won't go into the problems the Middle Ages had with Eve or the origins of sin. That's a whole other question. But she has already fallen. She understands the nature of what she has done, and she hasn't even done it yet. And it's already too late, you see. She has just reached, and the tear is coming out of her eyes. And she has assumed, in many ways, the form of a serpent. She is at one and the same time a bunch of different people. Remember, this thing is carved in a hunk of a very soft limestone. They've had to take it down. So it's in the museum, in the little tiny museum right next to the church now. And it's hung at eye level, which is really a blessing. And every time I'm there, about every other year, I go to the museum and have a conversation with Eve. And tell her everything came out okay and not to worry about it. But I love this lady. I really do. She's a very live person for me. I can't think of her as a hunk of stone. She's a puzzling woman. She's on the lookout for Adam. She is a penitent. She is a seductress. She is all these kind of things that Eve is. And Gizelbertus has really captured her beautifully. His most famous work at Autun is in the form of what we call historiated capitals. A capital is that little thing that sits on top of a column. You know, sometimes they look like celery stalks, sometimes they look like page boy bobs, you know, whatever. But a historiated capital is one that tells a little story. And this obviously is the Magi, beautifully carved.
It's very small. It's this is much bigger than actual size. This is one of my favorites. The flight into Egypt. Joseph is singing a canticle. Mary is very happy. Jesus is also happy, although I don't know why. That's a dumb way to ride a donkey in Egypt. And the donkey is excellently happy. This is a very happy donkey, and we are aware of the donkey's happiness, or the reason for the donkey's happiness, when we see the whole thing. Gizelbertus has given it wheels. So they are rolling on to Egypt. Sort of trucking. Trucking. This is my favorite. This is really my most... Three wise men in bed together. Now, you can tell they are wise men because they still have their crowns. It's a little risque. We do not know where the legs are. There's gotta be a tinge of overlapping there, but the blanket is hanging straight down, so we'll put the best construction on it. The angel, of course, has come to visit the wise men and tell them not to return the way they came, because Herod's got some mean plans for them. So the angel tiptoes into the three wise men's bed. And one wise guy, luckily, has his hand outside the covers, see? And the angel is coming in there and messing with his little finger. Now picture this, see? I mean, let's just say you're there. Oops. Let's just say you're there and you got your hands outside the cover and somebody's messing with your fingers, you know? And it's so beautifully designed. We got a line coming down here, you know, down to the little finger, and then up the bare arm and over to this little eye. He's got his eyes open. Over his head, he's got a little hey, Balthazar, is that you? Now this is very, very human. It's tremendously human, and it is delightful. At the same time, it is kind of foolish for one real reason. This is where they are. All of those historiated capitals are 65 feet up in the air. You can't see them.
How come you did?
I took pictures of it. With telephoto lenses and a skyhook. Now, isn't that incredible? I mean, that all kinds and manners of foolishness. They say that the Gothic Age is the age of faith. I guess I don't believe that. I really think of these 200 years following the 1,000 year mark as being the age of faith. This two-sided fear and foolishness combination. And I guess I would say that the Gothic Age, as it responds to this and builds on it, becomes more the age of piety than the age of faith. And there's a tremendous difference between those two. Okay, so to all of the people who did these silly things, architects and painters and sculptors from the Romanesque age, I have to include them all in my list of foolish friends. Okay, now this fellow does not come off quite so foolish. In fact, he comes off a little bit more bizarre than anything, but he desperately needs that we understand the context in which he did his major work. But this fellow is interesting for a couple of reasons. Matthias Grunewald is an artist whose work is probably altogether maybe only about 15, 16 pieces. And of those, 9 of them are in one painting. One painting has 9 different paintings in it. It's called a palette. So he doesn't have a lot to show for his efforts. He has even less than that. He doesn't even have a name to show. Matthias Grunewald is a name made up by art historians. Nobody knows who this guy was. All they know is that there is a composite body of work recognizable as having been done by one man and nobody else. They have very few documents. He didn't work for princes, for nobility, for royalty, and therefore he worked really on a level that common people were familiar with and could understand and comprehend. At the same time, since he worked at that level, no elaborate records were kept of how much he got paid or how long it took him to do this or that or the other thing. An anonymous guy with a small body of work. And it's very much in keeping with the style of his time, Renaissance, German, early 1500s, but it's pretty gruesome. He gets very, very graphic. I mean, a crown of thorns was exactly that. In fact, it was more like a bramble bush than a wreath of laurel. It was an instrument of torture. The people that mocked him really mocked him. They didn't just stand around. And the dead god is really dead. He doesn't float up there. He doesn't give benedictions. He doesn't cast off great gobs of light. People wring their hands. He has his feet crossed with a big spike run through both of them, and all of the stuff that ran down during the death pangs into his feet have made them look more like clubs than like feet. All the weight is hanging down, and he is dying as he did of suffocation.
I wish you'd had a close-up of the hands there.
On the cross?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Well, this is one version of a crucifixion that Grunewald did, which he repeated 3 times, and the most famous one is called the Eisenheim crucifixion. And that's this. Okay? Now, the Eisenheim crucifixion was done for actually, it was like a syndicate, sort of like a guild started in the Middle Ages. It was kind of like a Kiwanis. That's a terrible simile. but a civic enterprise of businessmen who operated a hospital. And the hospital was devoted specifically to the treatment of a disease known as St. Anthony's Fire. We're not exactly sure what St. Anthony's fire was. Some people think it's syphilis, or it was syphilis. Some people think it was an excruciating form of shingles. But since 2 popes missed the last gathering at Vatican II because they were suffering from St. Anthony's fire, we probably ought to go with the latter explanation. Two cardinals, rather, I'm sorry. And whatever it was at this time incurable. Your body broke out in pustules that just continually oozed. You could not be touched. And you just died a very slow, agonizing death. Well, in the hospital, when patients were brought to this hospital, which was in Eisenheim, the first thing that they were that was done to them was that they were cleaned, wrapped in a white sheet, and then taken down the whole aisle. The hospital at that time was very much like a church. Tall ceiling, open, almost no dividers. People were just laid out in a huge long ward. And they were led down the aisle, and at the end of this aisle was this huge altarpiece. And on the cross, Christ is dying of St. Anthony's fire. He is dying of the same thing that these poor beggars are dying of. Now, if you just look at this thing without that context, you see a fellow who has a kind of disgust fetish, you know, that he's sort of interested in making something as gruesome as possible. What he is actually concerned about is an interpretation of the crucifixion in such a way as to make the gospel of that horrible event immediately relevant to the people who are living next to this thing. Now, this is, as I say, a polytip, 9 paintings. So you open up that center panel on the, you see this painting in the center is split right in two. So you open that thing up and turn each of those panels back, and you have this thing. The most significant one of the painting there being that resurrection. Because as you see, Christ, who then has died and is resurrected, is really cleaned up. He is so white. He's white and shiny. So all of that stuff with which they are suffering has happened to Christ, going to happen to them. And it's opened up again. And here's some more stuff. This is an incredibly elaborate painting. I'd say the whole thing, when it's just opened up, like this wing right here, is as wide as this room. It's enormous. Now, on the final painting, you've got Anthony, St. Anthony, and St. Paul, the hermit. And over here, St. Anthony in torment. He's the guy after whom the fire was named. And look at this. Down in this lower right-hand corner, these are all the demons besetting St. Anthony. He was an ascete who was a hermit in the wilderness. And one little guy down in the corner, bloated belly, ready to just absolutely explode from this disease that everybody in that hospital is suffering from. In other words, St. Anthony here is really beset by visions and temptations. Consider your illness as a temptation. That's really interesting, fascinating thing. And when we look a little closer, we can see some of the detail, really neat stuff. It's not historical. My gosh, there's John the Baptist at the crucifixion. He's been beheaded by now. And a lamb under the cross, oozing blood into a chalice. It's a combination of very medieval and very Renaissance technical ideas. John the Baptist points to the cross. He points to the crucifixion, and there is a Latin inscription. It's almost like a cartoon with a little balloon coming out of his mouth. And he is speaking Latin, and the Latin translated says, "He must increase as I must decrease." That finger and that motto as being the symbol. I think it was Tillich that said, the reality of this is so intense that there's even a carbuncle on the end of John the Baptist's finger. I've sort of taken that whole little message as a personal concept of what art, as it relates to the Christian faith, ought to be. Pointing away from itself and to the object of faith, which is this horrific, pornographic body, cadaver, having assumed not only all of the pus all of the disease, all of this excruciating pain of these people who are... It is a terribly graphic concept of what the dead god is all about. And by golly, it ought to make you nauseated. Particularly compared with crucifixions that we are more accustomed to, which really don't convince us that he died. You know, that he sort of skipped that whole thing and went right on to the resurrection. Well, not for these guys. He took all of their stuff on him and buried it and took it to the death and rose again clean, white, and shiny. He's just glowing. That is Mr. Clean. Yeah, that's it. It's just glorious. The light is coming from the inside. You know, it's just an amazing, probably the finest resurrection painting ever done in the history of Christian art, to my way of thinking. It's a glorious thing. Well, it's a strange combination of paintings. These are all in one thing. Boy, this is an emotional trip, this painting is. You know, if you don't like what you're looking at, turn the page, you know. Scare the bejeebers out of you. Painting like this that gives some of the some of the contemporary historians the idea that probably Grunewald, along with Bruegel, were the precursors of Expressionism, of German Expressionism. Hieronymus Bosch would be probably also, except maybe even more Surrealism than Expressionism. Bosch is so fantastic. Okay. All right, our final guy. We're sure jumping. I hope you can tolerate the culture shock as we go from one period to another. It's my own personal belief that Van Gogh wasn't nearly as great a painter as he was a man. An incredible person, a Christian, but really a fool. Well, I guess that goes without saying, or it should. Van Gogh's real problem was that he took his faith literally. He took scripture literally. He would have made a good Missouri Synod. Like, for example, when the Bible says, if a guy asks you for half your coat, give him the whole thing. Well, Van Gogh would do this, but there was nothing on underneath, you see. And so he'd freeze and get pneumonia and have to go to the hospital. When the Bible says somebody wants to walk with you a mile, walk with him too. And Van Gogh would drag somebody for another mile. He really would. They really only wanted to go a mile. Van Gogh would make them walk 2 miles because that was scriptural. Whatever you have, you give to the poor. And he did that to his own deprivation. He starved himself. He became sick. He took in people that you did not want to associate with. He took in a woman of the streets who was pregnant by somebody who left her alone and destitute. This woman's mother wanted her back out on the streets so she could make some money and share it with her mom. And Van Gogh's dad, who was a pastor, didn't want him to have anything to do with such a person. But Van Gogh persisted. In fact, he... I hate to read stuff. But Van Gogh probably would have been considered a man of letters on the basis of the letters that he wrote to his brother Theo, would have been considered in literature if he hadn't been considered first in art. Now, he wrote some of the most beautiful things to his brother. This winter, I met a pregnant woman deserted by the man whose child she bore. A pregnant woman who in winter had to walk the streets, had to earn her bread, you understand how. I took that woman for a model. I could not pay her the full wage, but thank God I have been able thus far to protect her and her child from hunger. It seems to me that every man worth his salt would have done the same in a similar case. What I did was so simple and natural. The woman is now attached to me like a tame dove. I, for my part, can only marry once, and how can I do better than marry her? This gal was about 30, a very ordinary person, evidently had a terrible complexion according to Van Gogh's paintings, smallpox. She had venereal disease, which she gave to Vincent. Her name was Christine. Everybody convinced Van Gogh he should let her go. So Van Gogh decided to go away and leave her, and he wrote to her, "Perhaps you will not be able to keep quite straight, but go as straight as possible. As long as I know that you try your best and don't lose hold of everything, and that you are good to the children, as you know I have been to them, if you only act so that the children always find in you a mother, though you are but a poor servant, though you are but a poor whore, with all your damn faults, you will always, in my eyes, be good." That was Vincent. He did a slew of self-portraits, and the reason was he couldn't get anybody to sit for him. And it's been said that every one of his self-portraits looks different, but they all look like him, which gives us an idea of how many different people Vincent really was after he had cut off his ear. Boy, cold. Like a cypress tree. He's born in Holland, and he didn't paint until the last 10 years of his life. And produced during that time 400 paintings, 800 prints, and 1,400 drawings. Most of that during a period of 14 months. The guy was a whirling dervish. His early paintings are crude and very depressing. He wanted to be a pastor, and he couldn't. You know, somebody will sympathize with this. He couldn't handle the languages. Greek especially was just impossible for him. So he flunked SEM. And so he decided to go to a mission program that sent lay missionaries and preachers to parishes that no self-respecting minister would accept. And so he went to this little coal mining village in the south of Belgium. He got kicked out of there because he was making a fool of himself going down into the coal mines and having little hymn sings and things like that and having prayers. But what really did it was that he sided on the side of the miners in a strike. And the mine owners decided that they could do without Vincent. But he lived there and insisted for a while at least that this would be the place that he would stay all of his life, that he would minister to these poor people. And it's there that he learned to draw, that he got infatuated with the common folk. He really sympathized with ordinary people. And that's probably his most well-known painting from this time.
All of them.
Yes, yes. We should have told him you could put peanut butter and honey on those things.
No, just butter.
We could go to the shop and get Twinkies.
We shall play with the Twinkies.
Years and years. This is actually, as far as I'm concerned, a self-portrait. It's kind of, it reminds me of an icon. And it's very Dutch. It's very much like Rembrandt would have painted a self-portrait, or any kind of portrait, with a lot of gold and light coming from inside and around the object. But Vincent loved people so much that he turned them off. And nobody wanted to be around him, so he was alone an awful lot of his life. And the things that he painted and the things that he sketched were things that didn't fight and struggle with him. He finally decided that what he had to do, he was sick a lot of the time. Some of it was from drinking problems, but it's pretty well confirmed now that Vincent's malady was a type of epilepsy, a chemical imbalance. It was diagnosed as such specifically at the hospital at Arles or at Saint-Remy. And he would just go into these fits. He had grand mal seizures, and it terrified him. He just didn't know when one would occur. So he got everything caught up in the act of painting. He couldn't tolerate, for after a while, being in the cold north. And he was learning more about painting and getting color, learning about color, and decided he wanted to go where there was light. And so he went down to the south of France. And in a period of 15 months, painted over 200 paintings that are the finest output of probably anybody who ever painted within that particular time frame. It is just unbelievable, the output of this fellow. I don't want to go into the composition and Oriental influences and impressionistic influences, only to say that he celebrated more than anything light and color. That was his image. Everything he wrote to his brother Theo was about color. That's the little yellow house he lived in. Well, now, yesterday I was busy furnishing the house. Just as the postman and his wife told me, the two beds, to be really substantial, will come at 350 francs apiece, so I had to go on another tack. I bought one walnut bed and another in white wood, which will be mine and which I'll paint later. If Gauguin comes or someone else, there is his bed ready in a minute. I bought two chairs, a mirror, some small necessary things. Then there will be my own bedroom, which I want extremely simple, but with large solid furniture, the bed, chairs, and table all in white wood. The room you will have here then, or Gauguin, if Gauguin comes, will have white walls with a decoration of great yellow sunflowers. You will see these great pictures of sunflowers, 12 or 14 to the bunch, crammed into the tiny boudoir with its pretty bed and everything dainty. For it's going to be, I hope, a real scheme of decoration that I'm about to begin. As I've told you already, I'm going to paint my own bed. There will be three subjects on it. Perhaps a nude woman. I'm not decided. Perhaps a child in a cradle, I don't know. I bought of set purpose a mirror, good enough for me to be able to work for myself, because if I can manage to paint the coloring of my own head, which is not to be done without some difficulty, I shall likewise be able to paint the heads of other good souls. I just bought a dressing table with everything necessary, and my own little room is complete. Color is to do everything. The broad lines of this furniture must express inviolable rest. I'm hard at it, painting with the enthusiasm of a Marseillaise eating bouillabaisse, which won't surprise you when you know that what I'm at is the painting of some great sunflowers. That'd sure surprise me. What do you get so excited about, for goodness sake?
Now that I hope to live with Gauguin in a studio of our own, I want to make decorations for the studio. Nothing but big flowers. If I carry out this idea, there will be a dozen panels. So the whole thing will be a symphony in blue and yellow. I'm working at it every morning from sunrise, for the flowers fade so soon. And the thing to do is the whole at a flash. He loved this bridge. I think he painted it about a dozen times. He also had a thing for orchards, particularly in the spring, the bloom of orchards. I have a fresh orchard as good as the rose colored peach trees, apricot trees of a very pale rose. At the moment I'm working on some plum trees, yellowish white with thousands of black branches. I'm using a tremendous lot of colors and canvases, but I hope it isn't a waste of money all the same. I'm well started now, and I think I must have 10 more, the same subject. You know, I'm changeable in my work, and this craze for painting orchards will not last forever. Please send money. He sold one painting in his lifetime for about the equivalent of $28. That painting, 3 years ago, sold for $468,000. He thought nighttime had more life in it in many respects than daytime. I hear a song whenever I see this. I can't get it out of my head.
Oh, that's a trouble.
This is a trouble painting. A fascinating one. Vincent said of it that it was the ugliest painting he ever did. He said this was a room that you could commit a crime in. It was one of those nighttime scenes again, and he exaggerated the color. This marks him really, in contemporary art, at least art history, as the first real expressionist. Color as symbol. He thought it was ugly, but in its ugliness, he said, there is probably more meaning than in some of the beautiful paintings that I've done. Some people could tolerate Vincent for a while and sit there and pose. This was his favorite friend, a postman who liked to talk politics. And he painted him about six times. What were you thinking?
It's like his landlady.
Was his landlady.
Oh.
Smart.
Show off.
This is probably my favorite portrait of his, the old peasant. I come even to orange tones, chromes, and pale lemon yellow. Beyond the head, instead of painting the ordinary wall of the mean room, I paint infinity. A plain background of the richest, intensest blue that I can contrive, and by this simple combination of the bright head against the rich blue background, I get a mysterious effect like a star in the depths of an azure sky. In the portrait of the peasant, I worked in this way, but without wishing in this case to produce the mysterious brightness of a pale star in the infinite. Instead, I think of the man I have to paint, terrible in the furnace of the full harvest, the full south. Hence the stormy orange shades, vivid as red-hot iron, and hence the luminous tones of old gold in the shadows. I want to paint men and women with that something of the eternal which the halo used to symbolize, and which we seek to give by the actual radiance and vibration of our colorings. He thought of all folk as saints. This was his doctor toward the last months of his life, Dr. Gachet, who in one of his letters said, "I think he is in more need of help than I am." But he continued to go out into the city. Often he was confined. He confined himself to a sanitarium, and they would let him out with a keeper to keep him company while he went out. And yet once he went out by himself after a serious seizure and shot himself. He had corresponded with his brother all these years, and so Dr. Gachet thought it was very important that he be contacted, that his brother Tao be contacted, because while he shot himself, he missed his heart, and he lay dying up in his room. But Van Gogh would not give Dr. Gachet Tao's address, so Dr. Gachet wrote to Tao's employer, who finally contacted Tao, and days later Tao came to Vincent's room, where Vincent was sitting up in bed smoking a pipe. And they had a little conversation, and then Vincent simply said, "I think I want to go home." And he died. And Tao buried him in the little church in the little cemetery behind this church at Auvers.
Why did he cut off his ear?
A lot of people contend that he cut off his ear in a seizure, in a fit, but it was also a fit of extreme depression because his relationship with Gauguin, whom he thought would join him in a venture like an art school of some kind down in the South, just didn't pan out. They were two completely different personalities and they couldn't get along. This was extremely depressing to Vincent. And the ear was actually intended as a gesture of self, well, how can I say it? Of giving up a part of yourself as an ultimate gift. How do I make a connection with somebody? Gauguin had just run off with him, and now how do I connect with somebody? And the only thing he could think of at the moment in this fit of depression was to cut off his ear, give it as a gift to a prostitute in a local brothel, sent it to her all wrapped up in the daily paper. You know, like, for God's sake, listen to me. hear me, you know. Here's something of me. You know, you won't listen to words, you won't look at images. Here's a part of my body. Let me just read you something. This is how I look at it. To continue, that is what is necessary. But you will ask, what is your definite aim? Well, Tao, that aim becomes more definite, will stand out slowly and surely as the rough draft becomes a sketch and the sketch becomes a picture little by little by working seriously on it. You said, "We agreed in many things," but you added, "Since then you have changed so much, you are not the same any longer." Well, Tao, that is not quite true. If there has been any change at all, it is that I think and believe and love more seriously now what I already thought and believed and loved then. So you must not think that I disavow things. I am rather faithful in my unfaithfulness. And though changed, I am the same, and my only anxiety is, how can I be of use in the world? Can I serve some purpose and be of any good? One feels an emptiness where there might be friendship and strong and serious affections. And one feels a terrible discouragement, gnawing at one's very moral energy. And fate seems to put a barrier to the instincts of affection. And a flood of disgust rises to choke one, and one exclaims, "How long, my God?" Well, what shall I say? Our inward thoughts, do they ever show outwardly? There may be a great fire in our soul, and no one ever comes to warm himself at it. And the passers-by see only a little bit of smoke coming through our chimneys and pass on their way. Within 6 months after Vincent died, Teo died. Totally insane. Who was keeping who alive? Crazy friends.